Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities with Public Schools Unite Us initiative, and United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. Governor Kathy Hochul and New York State lawmakers struck a tentative budget deal early this week. The $254 billion spending plan is nearly a month late. As part of the agreement, the state will create a new charge for wearing a mask while committing a crime. WNYC's John Campbell reports.
Governor Hochul has been pushing for mask restrictions since images of masked anti-Israel protesters went viral last year. But some lawmakers raised concern about how the restrictions would be enforced. Assembly Speaker Carl Hastie says they struck a compromise.
It's really trying to concentrate on people who wear masks in regards to hiding their identity while they commit another crime.
The new charge would only apply if someone wore a mask with the intent of concealing their identity while committing a separate crime. In Albany, I'm John Campbell for the New York Public News Network.
Meanwhile, New York State is moving closer to approving medical aid in dying legislation. WNYC's Jimmy Vielkind with that story.
The state assembly is advancing legislation that would let doctors provide a lethal dose of drugs to terminally ill New Yorkers. Assemblymember Amy Pollan says the medical aid in dying bill would provide compassion. She told the story of her late sister.
The lasting memory I have of my sister is shouting in pain.
Several Democrats joined Republicans in voting against the bill. Max Rodriguez is a disability rights advocate. He's concerned ill people could be coerced into medically assisted suicide.
Really, we just need to kind of make sure that we're not opening Pandora's box.
It's unclear whether the bill will become law. State Senate leaders haven't scheduled a vote, and Governor Hochul hasn't taken a position on the subject. In Albany, I'm Jimmy Vielkind for the New York Public News Network.
Listening to the Legislative Gazette, program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. This week I sat down for a conversation with David Lombardo, host of the Capitol Press Room on WCNY, about the budget and the fact that the new $254 billion spending plan agreed to this week technically still isn't finished.
Yeah, we have a conceptual framework, handshake deal, whatever euphemism you want to use on the real big picture priorities of the governor and the legislature. But there are a lot of I's to dot, a lot of T's to cross. And on Thursday, the legislatures pass a budget extender, something to keep the budget funding in the interim before probably coming back next week to adopt a budget for the entire fiscal year, which runs through March 31st of next year. But as we speak, we haven't actually seen bill text yet, and we're waiting on about 9 budget bills.
Yeah, well, before we get into that, let's talk about the governor and what she's been pushing all along, the so-called affordability agenda. She says she got everything she wanted. Did she?
Yeah, in terms of the headlines, yes, she got exactly what she wanted. There are some tweaks to her proposals. For example, a rebate check has been scaled back a little bit in terms of its scope and what people will actually see and who's going to qualify. But what people need to know is basically if you're a family, you could be getting a check of up to $400. If you're an individual, it's up to $300, and this is based on your earnings from fiscal year 2023. And I think it's about 8 million filers who are going to be covered by this. So this is going to be one of those issues in the budget that has the largest reach. Whether people, when they realize that check in their bank account, are going to associate it with the state budget, whether they're going to associate it with Kathy Hochul is another thing. But that's definitely going to be real money in real people's pockets.
Well, I'm almost worried that the word reckless is going to be used eventually. Now, we see that the federal government is cutting things and that everybody I talk to now expects to be in a special session at some point to revisit what's going to happen. they've sort of just been going along with the idea, we'll wait and see, and we'll still plan the budget accordingly. But then I see this headline that came out from WNYC's Jimmy Vielkind, our colleague, that now the governor wants more power to adjust the budget to in case of federal cuts. And that, to me, is a power move.
It's a power move, but it's not a new one in Albany. Chief executives always want as much latitude over state spending as possible, and they already actually have a lot of discretion in terms of when money's going to go out the door, if money's going to go out the door. And we saw this in the past with Governor Andrew Cuomo during the pandemic. He wanted more power, and the legislature typically gives it to them because, not to speak ill of the legislature, but they like having an adult in the room. They don't want to be the one to make the tough choices when those tough choices need to be made. And they can then point to the second floor and say, hey, it's not us that rolled back some of your school aid. It's not us who limited some of your health care dollars. It's the governor. So I think it's likely that the governor's going to want some sort of discretionary power. But if we're talking about serious cuts at the federal level, then the legislature is going to actually have to come back in the fall, and they're going to have to be involved just because the scope of things is too great for the governor to act on alone.
Now, I see we have a new charge for wearing a mask while committing a crime.
Yeah, so this is one of those areas where the governor is going to talk for the headlines and say, I got what I wanted, which was restrictions on masks, but it's not exactly what she wanted. She felt in the wake of protests the last couple of years that masks had been used as a way to intimidate protected classes of people, for example, Jews in New York City and on college campuses. And what ended up being part of this budget deal is basically if you're committing a crime and in the commission of that crime, you're wearing a mask, that's basically a penalty enhancer. And what was interesting to me was that we saw this as a progressive criminal justice issue in terms of the opposition. But what ultimately seemed to be more meaningful in stopping the governor and what her agenda was labor unions, who apparently wanted the authority to be able to continue to protest, say, a work site and wear a mask so they could retain their anonymity. And here in Albany, I think you can always count on labor unions to have more sway than progressive criminal justice advocates. So I really think that's one of those interesting issues where a opponent that we maybe weren't counting on 6 months into this debate emerged and was the real game changer.
Let's go to Discovery. This is a huge issue. It's been going on for a while. It started with a lot of Republican criticism of bail reform. The governor seems to have tried to meet this where it is. And that's the evidence, right, that goes when a crime is committed. And many of the DAs were complaining for a while that that's too much of a bar to reach. They're understaffed. It's a lot of evidence they have to provide. They wanted some sort of middle ground. She seems to have worked that in.
Yeah, so the changes to pretrial evidence disclosure that was enacted in 2019, took effect in 2020, was a real game changer in terms of the dynamic between criminal defense attorneys and prosecutors. And the criminal defense attorneys would say that it was restoring a correct balance in terms of the access to evidence that they needed. What we've heard from prosecutors in the ensuing 5 years is essentially that the scales were tipped too far in the benefit of criminal defense attorneys, essentially giving them the ability to get cases tossed out as a result of technical errors, and judges didn't have enough wiggle room, so to speak, to say, okay, well, the prosecutors were trying their best and we should give them a little extra latitude. I should say criminal defense attorneys completely disagree with this framing of the issue and say that there already are avenues for prosecutors who are acting in good faith to ensure their cases are allowed to proceed. And they also point to the fact that a number of pretrial dismissals as a result of this statute is only been increased in New York City. And in the 57 other counties, you haven't really seen this same trend. But here is one of those issues where the governor was very successful in getting a version of what she wanted. And when I say what she wanted, I mean the district attorneys who were basically taking the lead on this. And based on the reporting and based on talking with Assembly Speaker Carl Hastie, it seems like it finally got resolved when Speaker Hastie, a Bronx Democrat, sat down with the New York City prosecutors and basically hammered out a deal that everyone could agree to.
That's David Lombardo, host of the Capitol Press Room on WCNY. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Canadians went to the polls this week after a national campaign that began on March 23rd. While in northern New York, expectations of strained relations and a continued trade war remain. More now from the Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley.
Canada is a parliamentary democracy, which means voters choose members of parliament and the leader of the winning party becomes prime minister. As of Tuesday morning, the Liberals won 168 seats, Conservatives 144, Bloc Québécois 23, NDP 7, and Greens 1. And it remained uncertain whether the Liberal Party would be in the majority or must form a minority government. SUNY Plattsburgh Center for the Study of Canada director Chris Kirky explains why the tally is incomplete.
There's a variety of votes that have yet to be counted. In Canada, they physically count every ballot. Some of these are from advance polling and advance voting that took place that needs to be counted by Elections Canada officers. Part of it has to do with what they call special voting. Let's say you're a Canadian citizen and you're outside of the country and you have to mail in your vote. And there's still some ridings where maybe one or two polling stations still need to report. You know, it may take 24 or 48 hours, but we'll have some certainty as to the outcome fairly soon.
Former Congressman Bill Owens, a Democrat who represented a New York district abutting the border, says the Liberals can thank President Trump for their victory.
Probably the biggest factor was Mr. Trump, both his comments about, you know, Canada becoming a state, but also the tariffs. And now Mr. Carney is going to have to see what he can do with Mr. Trump.
During his victory speech, Prime Minister Mark Carney slammed the American president and reiterated previous statements that the cordial relationship between the countries is irreparably damaged.
Our old relationship with the United States, a relationship based on steadily increasing integration, is over. We are over the shock of the American betrayal, but we should never forget the lessons. We have to look out for ourselves.
Owens does not anticipate a rapprochement in the short term.
I was at a meeting last week with a significant number of Canadians, including Jean Charest, who was the Prime Minister of Quebec, and they felt that this is going to take some time. The tariff problems could get solved, but the level of hurt and anger that Canadians feel because of Mr. Trump's activities may take significantly longer to dissipate. And I don't think we're going to see a return of Canadians for recreation, for shopping in the near term.
Kirky notes anecdotal evidence in the North Country that Canadians are turning away from their southern neighbor.
If you go around Plattsburgh these days, for example, especially on the weekends, and you take a look at the number of Quebec-plated vehicles, which populate everything from shopping malls to gas stations to restaurants to hotels, the number has dropped precipitously. And there's no reason right now for optimism in terms of seeing the return of the vibrant Quebec consumer coming down to the North Country, be it Plattsburgh, Lake Placid, or where have you. There's just too much uncertainty that exists in the Canada-U.S. relationship right now.
The Plattsburgh and North Country region is home to a number of Canadian-based manufacturers and businesses, and Canadian retail trade is a key factor in the local economy.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
Amtrak kicked off a reduced Empire service schedule between Albany and New York City Monday as it gears up for a long-delayed project renovating the East River Tunnel. As the Legislative Gazette's Jesse King reports, the disruption is prompting officials to call for changes.
Amtrak's $1.6 billion construction plan would fully close two of the four tunnels that make up the East River Tunnel over the course of 3 years, in order to address damage it says was made worse by Superstorm Sandy in 2012. The reduced schedule for the Empire service cuts two trains, including a southbound train leaving Albany at 12:10 p.m. and a northbound one departing Penn Station at 3:15. It also combines the Maple Leaf and Adirondack trains running from New York City to Toronto and Montreal, respectively, into one single train between Penn Station and Albany, resulting in an extended layover for passengers at Albany. Steve Strauss, executive director of the Empire State Passengers Association, says he supports the renovation of the East River Tunnel, but he worries the reduced service unfairly impacts passengers in the Hudson Valley, where ridership has increased since the COVID-19 pandemic.
When you include the round trip that was removed from the schedule back in November and never returned, there's a 23% reduction in train frequencies. So that's going to have a big impact because there's not going to be enough capacity in the corridor to meet the demand.
ESPA says Amtrak tickets in the Hudson Valley already sell out 3 to 4 days a week. ESPA isn't alone in calling on Amtrak to make changes. Governor Kathy Hochul this week voiced her concerns about the Empire service and potential disruptions at the Long Island Railroad, which also uses the East River Tunnel. She urged Amtrak to switch to a repair-and-place construction model, with work happening on nights and weekends. New York Congressman Mike Lawler, a Hudson Valley Republican who is considering a run for governor, has called on the Trump administration to force Amtrak to keep the tunnels open during the day. The Metropolitan Transportation Authority, which owns the LIRR, is also sounding the alarm. On Wednesday, the MTA board passed a resolution calling on Amtrak to reconsider.
All in favor of the resolution? Any opposition or abstention? The resolution is carried. Thank you.
MTA Chair Jan Oliber questions Amtrak's ability to address infrastructure and service issues as they arrive and says the MTA has repeatedly recommended a repair-in-place model.
And I ain't giving up these hard-won gains for on-time performance for Long Islanders because Amtrak is too hidebound to consider a different way of performing work.
Lieber acknowledges the East River Tunnel project has already been delayed multiple times, including to allow for the construction of Grand Central Madison, which provides an additional connection to Manhattan for the LIRR. Lieber says about 40% of Long Island passengers currently ride into Grand Central Madison rather than the East River Tunnel and Penn Station. In a statement, Amtrak President Roger Harris says Amtrak got approval for its plan from the MTA and New Jersey Transit, quote, several months ago, and that it has already considered the repair-in-place approach. Ultimately, he says, quote, the plan we are implementing proved to be the safest, most efficient, reliable, and timely to complete the full rehabilitation of East River Tunnel, making it the best use of taxpayer investments, end quote. Amtrak has agreed to add extra cars to each of the 10 remaining round-trip trains in its Empire service line, but Strauss worries it won't be able to fulfill that promise after its Horizon railcar fleet was pulled for safety concerns last month. He recommends Amtrak donate some coaches from its Northeast Regional line.
This spring, they will be bringing into service a number of new trains on the Northeast Corridor, the Acela replacement fleet. If that goes very well, by sometime in the fall, they may have the ability to take a few coaches off of Northeast Regional trains and shift a few of those coaches to the Hudson Valley and the Empire Corridor. And we're only talking about 4 or 5 coaches at most.
ESPA also recommends Amtrak shift the Maple Leaf and Adirondack train schedules to shorten layovers in Albany. Ultimately, Strauss has this advice for Hudson Valley passengers.
Make your plans in advance and buy your tickets as far in advance as you can. If you're flexible, travel on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Those tend to be the lowest ridership days and the days with the most tickets at lower prices.
Amtrak says construction is expected to start May 9th. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Jesse King.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gastina. Unionized nurses at Nathan Litauer Hospital continue to protest what they say is an unacceptable, quote, final contract offer from management. The Legislative Gazette's Aaron Shella Levine explains.
What do we want? When do we want it?
Now!
What do we want?
New York State Nurses Association members at the Gloversville Hospital have been picketing, demanding better pay and lower health insurance costs. Dozens of nurses and supporters dressed in bright red shirts chant at the entrance to the hospital's parking lot.
Patients are sicker. Technology has come into the hospital since I've been a nurse. And
our challenges, that the challenges that the nurses face are more difficult.
Nurse Marion Enright has worked at the hospital for 36 years. Earlier in April, nurses marched to CEO Sean Fidal's office demanding a better contract. Enright says they'll continue to protest until then.
This is not just about a contract. It's about patient care in our community. It's about our hospital. We take care of our families, our friends come here, our neighbors, and it's very concerning that the CEO is oblivious to our concerns and our demands.
Nathan Latour did not respond to a request for comment. Speaking as cars roll past, maternity nurse Wendy Bowie said a poor contract impacts patient care.
During the course of my career, New York State has lost over 500 maternity beds, and I am worried for our hospital, and I'm worried for the future mothers and the care they'll receive when management continues to disregard the nurses who care for them.
Some said they have to pay nearly $1,200 a month for the hospital's family insurance plan, and a proposed 15% raise over 3 years isn't enough to make ends meet. Bowie says this creates higher stress on the nurses who do stay at the small but vital hospital.
I grew up in this area. This is my community, and it's important. And delivering our babies is important. But my dedication has been taken advantage of. If I'm sick, if a nurse is sick, and they can't come to work, that creates intense pressure on an entire unit. Placing patients and nurses in safe and unsafe and dangerous conditions. We shouldn't have to work sick, and we shouldn't have to pick up extra time and overtime to ensure that our coworkers and patients aren't in those situations.
Democratic State Assembly member Phil Steck of the 110th District joined the demonstration.
We have had a situation where our healthcare system has been declining over time. And we have had people who think that it's about making as much money as possible for themselves and not about patient care. If you want to go into this field as a hospital administrator, you should be committed to the public interest and not to your private personal interest.
Fidal told the Leader Herald that the contract offer the hospital made April 3rd was fair. Bowie remains optimistic that the union and the hospital administration will be able to reach an agreement. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Aaron Shello-Levine.
It's graduation season, and as students prepare to leave college life behind, some say they're not ready to enter the workforce. The Legislative Gazette's Samantha Simmons spoke with students at two Capital Region higher education institutions and filed this report.
In the well of concrete known as the main fountain at the University at Albany, students study in the sun before taking a dip post-graduation. Jeremy Daly is hanging out with friends. Daly is a history major, but he doesn't plan on putting his degree to work, at least directly. He's going into the trades to be an electrician.
Well, it's kind of what I realized I wanted to do before college, but I still just wanted to go to college to, I guess, meet people.
Do you regret going to college and doing the money instead of just starting right out of high school in, like, a trade?
It's a question I've asked myself a lot. No, because I met good people.
Daly says he's excited to get his life started and spend time with his family and friends. Students like Daly are entering an uncertain job market. While statewide unemployment rates were down 0.1% in March from 4.3% to 4.2%, according to the New York State Department of Labor, many businesses and state agencies have paused hiring while awaiting clarity on the tariff wars. Across the river, students at Hudson Valley Community College in Troy are weighing their choices between entering the workforce or continuing on to a four-year school. Playing volleyball with classmates, Ryan Connors will be graduating this year. Connors, who plans to transfer to a four-year school, says he is not worried about finding a job. A business administration major, Connors says it can't be that hard.
You know, absolutely no fear. I don't think job security is a huge worry. I think even in today's society, if you don't have a job, there's still always ways to make money. You know, everyone has access to the internet here, and if you do, there's absolutely no excuses to not make money. You know, I'd really hope for a good job, but if not, the only thing stopping me besides that is laziness. So
around the corner, Tyler Hines is leaving class. Hines, a digital media major, has been doing freelance work and making connections to design websites, create logos, and more.
my family had connections, so I met with their connections, and those people work for the state, so kind of just solidified relationships with those people so I could rely on them when needed.
Some students, however, are pushing off the working world to pursue higher education. Claire Hart studies psychology and sociology at UAlbany. She says she hasn't done any internships or clinicals yet, but suggests undergrads do. Hart was accepted to grad school at UAlbany, but is deferring for a year. In the meantime, she'll be teaching in a job she got through a relative's husband.
Like, I feel like I've been lucky or taken everything kind of for granted, and maybe I'll get like a rude awakening. So I guess I am a little nervous.
Noah Simon is UAlbany's Director of Career and Professional Development. Simon has worked for the university for 18 years. He says getting a job this year is not any harder than past years for most students. Simon says college goes by quick, and some students are in denial when it's time to move on. He adds the department has seen an increase in first-year students using the service.
Some students are more eager to engage that process post-college, and others, and it's not going to change this year, it's not going to change next year, it's not going to change in the next 10 years. Students are going to be students, and some are going to put it off until they have to tackle it, and others are going to engage it earlier.
Simon says locally, cuts to federal funding in fields like environmental and social work haven't affected students' job search yet.
I think there is more awareness, certainly, of, you know, seeing some of the cuts that are happening in federal government and looking at opportunities, but that's something we always talk about. Too often, individuals in their job search get stuck in, I'm studying X, so I've got to go work in this field. And we need all job seekers and students, of course, to say, you know what, I'm studying, and you name it, it could be a psychology, it could be an accounting, it can be anything. You know, maybe I should look in other industries. And it's getting students to broaden their horizons.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Samantha Simmons.
And that about does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. We had help from the New York Public News Network. You can listen anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. Look for program number 2518. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina. Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.